Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Mark Stout, historian of the museum. I'm a PhD author and historian who served for 13 years as an analyst in the U.S. intelligence community. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. Our subject today is intelligence and Saddam Hussein, and we're fortunate to be joined by two people who are actually friends and former colleagues of mine, Kevin Woods, a research staff member from the Institute for Defense Analyses and a retired U.S. Army officer, in fact, an Apache pilot in the U.S. Army back in the day, who has recently completed his doctorate in history at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. And we're also joined by Dave Palkey, who's the Deputy Director of the Conflict Records Research Center at the National Defense University. He'll tell us a little bit more about this, and who's working on his PhD in political science at UCLA, which actually deals with Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Both David and Kevin have been working for years in records captured from Saddam Hussein's regime, and Kevin has also had the opportunity to interview quite a number of senior Iraqi officials from the former regime, including, as I understand it, a few who've since been hanged for war crimes, and also including senior intelligence officials from Saddam Hussein's regime. Between them, they've co-authored at this point three books, a couple of shorter monographs, and maybe half a dozen or so journal articles. I've joined them as co-author on, I think, one of those books and two of those articles. But these are the real experts. We have with us today really two of the leading experts on Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and we want to talk a little bit about how he thought about intelligence and how intelligence played in his world. The immediate occasion for this is the publication this month, October 2011, of the Saddam tapes, The Inner Workings of a Tyrant's Regime, 1978 to 2001, of which all three of us actually were co-editors. So David and Kevin, welcome to the International Spy Museum.
Thank you.
Let's start with the question of what are the Saddam tapes? Where did these materials come from? And are we just talking about tapes, or are we talking about other materials out of Saddam Hussein's regime?
When U.S. troops came into Iraq in 2003, they captured thousands of hours of audio files of meetings between Saddam and his generals, tribal sheikhs, visiting diplomats, his cabinet, his Revolutionary Command Council, and others. Of those, around 2,300 involved Saddam as a participant. So there's an amazing amount of material covering several decades that this study draws from. And there are hundreds of thousands of pages, probably millions of pages, of other types of documents from the regime, including transcripts of meetings, intelligence assessments, diplomatic communications, and so on.
And many of these documents, as I understand it, are now being made available to scholars. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? That's your lot in life at the moment.
That's exactly right. At the Conflict Records Research Center, where I work, we make available around 34,000 pages of captured records from Saddam's regime, as well as we have a separate collection from Al-Qaeda, and affiliated movements, primarily from Afghanistan, that we make available to scholars, along with full English translations. We're constantly building the collection, so scholars can contact me or they can visit our website to learn how to come and conduct research at our center. And we're excited about expanding the collection and growing it as quickly as we can.
Well, our new book is the Saddam Tapes. Are the tapes in that collection as well? Can people go to the Conflict Records Research Center and listen to Saddam speak in Arabic?
Absolutely. Right now, about two-thirds of the tapes that we sample in this book are available in the center. We have about 150 separate audio files in the CRRC involving Saddam that people can come and listen to. And the rest that are in this book are underway. We're working to migrate them into the center as well. So pretty soon scholars will be able to come and to listen to all of the audio files in this book, as well as others which aren't on the book.
Kevin, you've been doing a lot of work on the history of the Iran-Iraq war, a war about which most people in the West don't know a whole lot. And to the extent they do know anything about it, their mental image of it is it was sort of a brainless slugfest, sort of the way they like to imagine World War I. To what extent did intelligence play a role on the Iraqi side in the Iran-Iraq war? Was there anything more sophisticated going on here than what appears? What role did intelligence play?
Well, typical of most of the studies we've done on Iraq in the last few years, the answer to the question is it's both more than you expect and a lot less than you would expect. At the beginning of the Iran-Iraq war, based on a study of the documents and some interviews, it's always amazed me is the degree to which Iraq did not fully understand its neighbor. Did not understand Iran. Its intelligence assessments are rather simplistic, or at the best, They were strategic assessments, but lacking in any kind of depth as far as the ability of the Iraqi military to accomplish a set of strategic objectives that Saddam laid out for them in the summer of 1980. As the war wore on, reality hit home, and Iraq did quite a bit of work to improve its intelligence capabilities, both its technical capabilities on the battlefield as the military developed experiences learned. They filled a lot of body bags to learn what works and what does not. They developed capabilities. They had some help from the outside, some help from the Soviet Union and other allies in the region. They had some help from the United States later on in the war, but not very much. They developed autonomous capabilities as far as expanding their General Military Intelligence Directorate, the IAS, their foreign intelligence capabilities. But it really grew as a capability throughout the war.
I understand you alluded to technical collection there. I understand that we're beginning to get some insights from some of the interviews you've done and some of the records of really special capabilities that they may have had during the war.
Yeah, I was somewhat surprised. In one of the interviews we did with a general, and then some of the documents that are available in the CRC actually back this up, is that sometime probably in the area of 1983, 1984, the Iraqis developed, with some assistance, at least according to the interviews from the former KGB, or from the KGB at the time, some capability to do signals intelligence near real time. And so in accordance to these interviews, the Iraqis had very good, again, after about the 1984 time frame, and even more so by 1986, very good tactical signals intelligence. In other words, they were able to, in near real time, break the Iranian codes, specifically between the Iranian regular forces and Tehran. They were less able to listen in on the revolutionary forces of Iran.
The Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's not 100% clear why. One of the suppositions, at least from the Iraqis, was that they were much less willing to use signals equipment. They did a lot of their communicating face-to-face or in document exchange. They didn't even trust the regular Iranian army, so they weren't sure they were going to broadcast their plans.
One of the things that's happened during the Iran-Iraq War that's become politically controversial in the United States since is that the United States shared intelligence about the Iranian military and its dispositions on the battlefield, primarily, at least from what we know from public reporting, based on imagery, but shared intelligence about Iran with Iraq. What was Saddam's view on this intelligence assistance that he was getting from the United States? Did he view this as important and helpful, or how did he take this?
Well, it's interesting. I'll start just by saying, you know, in the public domain here in the U.S., there's the debate in two different camps. One says this information provided by the United States as part of its balancing strategy, if you look at it that way, was very helpful. One study indicated that it was very helpful, especially in the 1986 Al-Fall campaign. In another case, it was not very helpful, that it was either junked up or it was so dumbed down as to not to be specifically helpful enough. From Iraq's point of view, it was viewed with great distrust.
From Iraq's point of view, you mean
Saddam's point of view, predominantly mm-hmm. Saddam's point of view. It was viewed with great distrust. Saddam always had a very difficult relationship with the United States through the 1980s, despite what's been said after the fact, that he never really trusted the United States, but he couldn't do without the United States. That was the nature of the Cold War competition over the Middle East at the time. But he didn't trust it. He repeatedly warned his staff not to trust what the Americans were providing. He repeatedly warned his staff to be very cautious that whatever we provide the Americans in return, or whatever the Americans learn about our plans based on what they provide us, he was convinced would be shared with the Iranians. To the point, by the 1988 campaign, Saddam was actually directing that based on the quality of information the Americans are providing, when you do your campaign plans for the final push against Iran, make sure you include a deception plan so that the Americans don't understand the nature of our plans coming up, because they'll just share them with the Iranians.
And I'll add to that really briefly. He told his advisors, beware the Americans, they're the police for Iran. Anything they have, they'll turn over to the Iranians.
They're the police for Iran.
Exactly. He said, be even more aware of them than the Iranians. So it was very much intended that we wouldn't figure out what was going on.
Well, since you mentioned that, one of the things that shows up in the Saddam tapes in the book is Saddam, right around the time of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, speculating that the Iranian Revolution may have been done at the behest of the United States, that we're behind this, that this serves our interest. And you were talking, Kevin, about how he really didn't understand Iran. Do you really think that he could possibly have believed that the Iranian Revolution, which from America's point of view was an utter disaster and led to a 444-day national humiliation, was something that we engineered?
Well, I mean, he wouldn't be the first one. There were all kinds of rumors running around at the period about what the role of the United States was vis-a-vis the Shah's departure and the nature, the timing and the events surrounding the Shah leaving Iran and the like. So it's not clear to me whether Saddam believed or didn't believe, but Saddam throughout his history, and it shows up throughout the tapes, was very quick to jump on conspiracy theories and try to, you know, try to disassemble reality into a way that he can make the conspiracy theories fit. It's never, I'd be very cautious about saying he believed one or another, but in private, very high level conversations, he actually wanted to explore these things very well. And certainly in the early years, 1979, 1980, as reflected in the tapes, he did believe the U.S. was very much behind some of the machinations of events in the Middle East, mainly because he saw himself as the rising power. So everything that was happening around him was relative to his objectives, his relative strength in the region, and that the U.S. would do anything it could to meter that situation as opposed to react to the other situations, revolutions, and the like.
So he was open to these possibilities.
Oh, absolutely.
At the very least.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Something else that happened actually during the period of the Iran-Iraq War was here in the United States, or centered here in the United States, and that's the Iran-Contra scandal, a very complicated story, but which involves the famous Oliver North, the National Security Council staff, the CIA, William Casey, American weapons being shipped to Iran, support for the Contras in Nicaragua. But the key thing, I think, from Saddam's point of view was that the Iran-Contra scandal involved us shipping weapons to his enemy, Iran, that he was fighting with at the time. This became, you know, major international news, the scandal did, and I can't imagine that Saddam Hussein took very well to this.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, the issues with the Contras and domestic law in the U.S. weren't even a footnote or a side note in the meetings that he had with his staff after the revelations began to break. He held at least six or seven meetings, which we have on audio files of, from this period, in which he described the Americans as conspiring bastards. Great quote from Saddam. He spoke about this stab in the back. How could we provide the Iranians with weapons and with intelligence at the same time as we were supposedly tilting toward Iraq? He and his advisors suggested that perhaps the U.S. even reestablished relations in 84 specifically so that we could do these things behind Iraq's back without Iraq suspecting us. So it's quite amazing. He and his advisors referred to it as Irangate, rather than Iran-Contra. And this left us, it had a great influence on Saddam. Tariq Aziz, his foreign minister, recalled years later when he was interrogated in U.S. captivity that Iran-Contra devastated Saddam's trust in the U.S., whatever there had been previously, and may have contributed to his decision to invade Kuwait, according to Tariq Aziz. In fact, Saddam later, after invading Kuwait, spoke about the conflict with the Americans as beginning in 86 when we were arming Iran behind his back and providing it with intelligence.
In 1990 and then in 1991, we had, of course, the invasion of Kuwait and then the subsequent Desert Storm, what Americans call the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. From the Iraqi point of view, it was the second Gulf War. The first one having been with Iran.
Or the mother of all battles.
Or the mother of all battles, right, yes. Can you talk a little bit, Kevin, about what their main sources of intelligence were during this period? The United States is used to having tremendously capable intelligence of also technical capabilities, particularly analytic capabilities, human capabilities, basically, and we really saw it rolling out for the first time. We were able to pretty much see the complete battlefield in its totality, and really have a very good understanding of what was going on. What tools did Iraq have intelligence tools did they have during Desert Storm period?
Well, I have to say, for the research we did on a book-length study for Operation Desert Storm, the 1991 war, I was somewhat surprised. I guess I came in with a typical American mindset, and I was looking for parallels in the Iraqi system that I would expect to see in the American system. And I found a very truncated or at best an immature system in that way. They had very good intelligence. It's like anything else. They were very good at certain things. They were very good at intelligence and security from the inside out. The farther you got away from Baghdad, the farther you got from the center of power, the weaker and weaker the quality and sources of information became.
So if I understand correctly, sorry to interrupt, but you mean they're very good at domestic intelligence and domestic security and keeping the Shia down and preventing a coup and that sort of thing, but
right.
not necessarily so good at understanding the outside world.
Correct. The system is overwhelmingly key to the internal security. So as you looked at the kind of operational intelligence necessary to defend a nation, so to speak, in the 1991 case, they depended on friends and neighbors. So they did receive intelligence from allies, the quality of which is probably suspect and opened all kinds of interpretation. They did use some human assets, so they did try to place people in ports and key areas around the Middle East that could do reporting. The quality of the reporting, even in some of the captured documents, is actually very poor when you compare it to our known. Like, this is what was offloading in Saudi Arabia at the time, and here are some reports of the same activity. And there's quite a variance in many, many cases. It's not clear why. They did have battlefield signals intelligence, a low-level tactical signals intelligence, the same that they had developed during the Iran-Iraq War. But, of course, the U.S. was a much harder case in the sense that they, I would presume, they didn't break our codes. There's no evidence they did, so they weren't able to listen to U.S. signals intelligence. But there was a lot, and I actually did an interview with the former head of the General Military Intelligence Directorate, and I asked him directly, what was your primary as the head of military intelligence, the Defense Intelligence Agency equivalent? What was your primary source of operational strategic military intelligence on the U.S. operations in 1990? And he said the Western media. And they actually, after the war, did a short study to ask the question, how often, if a military operation is discussed in Western media sources, high quality, you know, major newspapers and outlets in the West, is it discussed before the event? How often does it take place in accordance to the way that that newspaper discussed it? And they said for major U.S. media outlets, it was 80-90% accurate that this would happen on such and such a day. These are the units involved, and this is the basic scheme maneuver. And for the Iraqis, that was a very high high-quality source of material compared to, you know, Tariq Aziz even derisively referred to the cocktail intelligence that would be passed off as real knowledge from some of their overseas operations that they thought that, you know, the debates in the U.S. press about various schemes of maneuver out of Saudi Arabia to seize Kuwait were much more helpful. Now, in the grand scheme of things, actually not very helpful because of the limitations of the Iraqi military vis-a-vis the actual battlefield. But that was the primary source of intelligence for the larger operational questions.
So our open source press.
And
one has to imagine that this must have been tremendously confusing, though, because I remember the Desert Storm period, and for that matter, 2002 and 2003, before Operation Iraqi Freedom, and every retired colonel and retired general and civilian defense expert is getting on television and talking about how, well, the coalition might do this or the coalition might do that, and they've all got really great ideas, but there's a thousand different concepts floating around out there if you're watching CNN. Let alone now, you know, later on the other news networks. This must have been tremendously confusing to the Iraqis if they're depending on open source materials.
Well, in fact, you see that debate play out. So it's probably not unlike a debate that may play out in our intelligence services when they're trying to judge the veracity of concepts that they see through our primary systems. The Iraqis, using their primary system, multiple media sources, if you will, would end up with different concepts. And you can see the debate in the Iraqi documents on trying to determine which one best lines up with the other sources of information, be it human or tactical SIGINT or whatever they had. But it did become very confounding to them. And in fact, part of the success of the famous left hook in the 1991 war, the movement out to Western Saudi Arabia to swing in through Iraq, was actually discussed in the American press. And there was a debate in Iraq on whether or not that was a credible course of action. And it didn't match up with the human intelligence they had about the force dispositions. And so it was debated to the point where it became irrelevant because it was too late. By the time they could react, U.S. air power could be applied, and there was no option for the Iraqis to shift out west to do anything about it. So that became their problem, is having to differentiate between the options.
We've talked a little bit about the one of the main intelligence threat, or the one of the main security threats, rather, that the Saddam's regime thought it faced was domestic. Can you talk a little bit about the use of the intelligence services to hunt down dissidents and people that they thought were a threat to the regime, whether it was in, say, northern Iraq or abroad. Was there much of an assassination kind of effort aimed at dissidents?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily look at it in terms of an assassination program. We did a study that's been released, kind of a five-volume collection of intelligence documents dealing with Saddam and terrorism. And as a fallout of that, there are some discussions in the documents about going after threats to the regime. But mostly, it was, as you point out, that it was the dissidents that had gone to the near abroad, or it was the Kurdish various Kurdish groups, which in various times during the life of the regime were either in cahoots with Baghdad or on the outs with Baghdad. And so that world was constantly changing over the near 30-year career of Saddam as the leader. But they did. They set up a lot of intelligence organizations, and then because internal security was the key to survival for the regime, more so than any other aspect of what that government did, they became pretty adept at it. Now, it was a very East German-like system. They collected everything on everybody at all times, and they had to collect on the collectors at all times. So there was a proliferation of intelligence activities and agencies designed to watch other agencies, to the point where by the late 1990s, it could probably be argued that that was the sclerosis, if you will, of the whole process. Everybody was watching everybody, and there was no real freedom of movement inside the system.
In our first book, I seem to recall running across a document discussing the question, this would have been in the mid to late 1990s, of whether they should give internet access to Iraqi government agencies. And as I recall, they said, well, of course, if we're going to provide internet access to government officials, we're going to have people to monitor what they're doing on the internet. And the security services have enough people to do the monitoring, but they don't have enough people to monitor the people who were doing the monitoring. And so in the end, as I understand it, they disapproved internet access at
that
time.
Correct. It was overruled, if you will, based on that inability to watch the watchers, which I think became kind of that's kind of a description of how the entire system was collapsing under its own weight by the late 1990s.
Yeah, it's tremendously inefficient when you think about it.
At the very least.
Well, since you mentioned the topic of terrorism, was there any connection through the Iraqi intelligence services between Saddam's regime and al-Qaeda?
Well, in the study we did looking at documents, and again, there's no way to say anything is comprehensive, the simple answer to the simple question is no. Not a direct operational relationship as it was debated in the U.S. During that period. But that's not the whole answer, because Saddam and his regime had long and extensive connections with what we would consider non-state actors, terrorist organizations of a full range of motivations, everything running from Palestinian-affiliated terrorist organizations over the 70s and 80s and 90s, to an surprisingly increasingly number of small Islamist-focused terrorist organizations starting in the early 90s, a little bit before, but really starting in the early 90s. And you have to ask yourself a question, is that a connection to terrorism, or is that a matter of staying, you know, close to the action so you know what's going on? And I'll give one anecdote to show what I mean by that. In the early 1990s, there was a small, almost hyper-radical Salafist group in northern Kurdistan. And this is in reporting in the Iraqi documents that are in the CRC. And an intelligence officer met with them and was writing a report back to Baghdad and said, "I've met with this group. They are very extreme in their religious beliefs and their ideals. What should I do? Should we have a relationship with them or not?" And Baghdad's reply, the IIS reply back to the agent was, "Well, they seem rather small, but it's probably worth giving them some money and maintaining a relationship with the leadership." So is that a case where Saddam is supporting a terrorist group in which we, you know, it appears from the documents this was at least part of, if not the Ansar al-Islam as discussed? Or is that an intelligence agency trying to maintain visibility over an activity on its border that may or may not be a threat, or maybe something they could utilize as a tool, as it did against Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, as Iraq did against its neighbors in various ways? So it's a very difficult question to come up with a simple yes-no answer on the terrorism.
I want to come back, actually, apologize for just 1 minute, to Desert Storm. And I think one of the big questions that people had at the time was whether Saddam's military forces were going to use chemical or biological weapons against the coalition. And there's a famous story about then-Secretary of State James Baker having delivered a threat, which has been interpreted as a nuclear threat, to tell the Iraqis they darn well better not use weapons of mass destruction on us. Do the tapes give us any insight into Saddam's thinking on why, in fact, he did not at the time use this enormous arsenal of chemical and biological weapons?
I don't know that there's a smoking gun in the tapes, but I do think there's a lot of evidence all pointing generally in the same direction, whether you're talking about interviews that have been conducted with regime participants or material in the tapes indicating that Saddam was concerned about, he didn't think a U.S. nuclear weapon usage would be unthinkable. At the time that he invaded Kuwait, in a number of meetings, both right before and after the invasion, he expressed concern that the U.S. might use nuclear weapons against us in response for the invasion. One can take these at face value or not. I tend to take them at face value, given the settings in which he made these statements and the frequency with which he made them.
Was Secretary Baker's threat itself the key thing that deterred him, or?
I don't think so. I think long before then, he thought that U.S. nuclear weapons use was very thinkable. The State Department's released a transcript of that meeting in which I think it's an extraordinarily vague threat, which one could interpret as nuclear or in 10 or 20 other ways as well, pulling out his mustache, pursuing him, prosecuting him for regime crimes. Crimes against humanity, that type of thing.
Much in the way that U.S. forces going into Iraq in 2003 were wearing chemical equipment, defensive chemical protective gear, on the idea that Iraq had chemical weapons in the 1980s, and obviously the open question about whether there were still an operative capability in 2003 is kind of beyond the scope of this, but there was the military assumption that this is a reasonable probability and you have to deal with it, probability. Iraq in the fall of 1990, the Iraqi officers in Kuwait and in southern Iraq actually sat down and tried to do the calculations of what battlefield nuclear weapons would look like in a fight with the Americans. And they actually talked about how far apart do division headquarters have to be survivable if that became a possibility. Baghdad actually came up with and supposedly exercised at a very nominal level an evacuation plan for key districts of Baghdad, in light of the possibility that such a strike could occur, given a reaction by the United States to something Iraq may or may not do. So whether or not that indicates Saddam believed or not, the system around him accepted as at least probable, at least reasonable to expect, that given that our adversary, in this case the United States and the coalition, possess these kind of weapons and we are not willing to back down on certain points, this is something that a reasonable man would want to have to do. And there's evidence in the records that the Iraqis took it seriously.
You talked with, not only have you been looking at the records and listening to the tapes, but Kevin, you've talked with a number of the senior officials of Saddam's regime, you know, as it was constituted at the end, in 2003. In the run-up to the 2003 Operation Iraqi Freedom that overthrew Saddam, ultimately, what did Saddam, and to the extent that they were entitled to an opinion, his intelligence services think were the main threats? How would they rank order the threats that they understood to be out there facing them?
Well, it's one of the things we noted in that first book, the OIF book, was again, it goes back to that we already mentioned about Saddam's internal paranoia and the ability to maintain command or maintain control of the country, meaning you had to maintain control of the country in a very intimate way. And it was from an inside out, and that was the same way they viewed all threats. So, you know, sitting in Baghdad, sitting across the table from the former Minister of Defense of Iraq, and asking about his view of threats, I generally expected a response having to do with me being an American sitting in Baghdad talking to the former head of Minister of Defense. But it wasn't. He said, no, the number one threat to Iraq was internal. And the military, to a lesser degree, but certainly the security services, were primarily focused on a repeat of the 1991 post-war uprisings. So the internal security was paramount, and whatever happened from an external threat was going to precipitate this internal uprising. And so that was a predominant factor in planning. And that affected the disposition of troops, the way you used your reserves, who you put in charge, where you placed the command and control centers, had as much to do with that uprising as it had to do with anything that the Americans could bring from the outside.
I think you have a pithy phrase I've heard you use about that primary threat, about a knife.
Yeah, it was in one of the discussions, and I can't remember who it was, but he gave me the analogy that if you have three enemies and one of them is in the room with you with a penknife, and one of them is in the valley with you and he has a sniper rifle, and one is in the next valley and he has a howitzer, he has an artillery piece, all three want to kill you. but you know, obviously the pen knife is a pretty low-level threat, but if the light goes out in the room, you really don't care much about the guy with the sniper rifle or the artillery piece. You're in a room in the dark with a guy with a knife, and that's the way the regime saw their life in Baghdad. And you can almost picture this running from basement to basement from the various safe houses during the campaign, as dangerous as an invasion from the United States might otherwise be. The idea that at any minute the people surrounding you could rise up like they did in 1991, not in Baghdad, but certainly in the south and in the north, was by far the most dangerous threat. For an amazingly long period of time, actually into the OIF campaign, it was a very, very much a primary concern.
Where did they rank the threat from regional adversaries like Iran and Israel vis-a-vis the American and British threat?
Well, I think it changed over time. I'll let David comment on it, but I think it varied over time. Israel was, at least in my reading of the transcripts, looking at the documents, was always seen as this strategic threat. But it's strange in its way because it's a strategic threat, but there was also a limited degree of preparation for the threat. So it's almost like it was a rhetorical threat in the sense that they could use it for internal consumption or regional power plays, what it represents. There was a significant concern, for obvious reasons, about Iran. The war with Iran, Saddam declared a victory, but it was somewhat of a pyrrhic victory in terms of what occurred after the fact. Iran was getting stronger even as Iraq was getting weaker, and Saddam saw this through the 1990s. They're notwithstanding their current issues and challenges, they relative to Iraq, Iran was getting much stronger, and it's a much larger nation. And he saw it as aggressive. And so some of the reasons that he went to war with Iran in 1980 were still on the table. It was the issue with the Shia population and the control over that population and its relative strength inside of Iraq's borders. That made Iran a very, very strong threat, and that's almost a dominant threat in his mind as far as external.
You mentioned Israel. There do seem to be very interesting views of Israel here. We have a tape in the book where Saddam and some of his colleagues are discussing the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and speculating that perhaps the Mossad did that one. We've seen documents from Iraqi military intelligence, I believe it was, talking about how Jews were intrinsically better at the intelligence game and better at spying because they were intrinsically secretive and sneaky people. There's another document I recall from our first book about Pokemon, the children's entertainment, in which I guess the General Military Intelligence Director reported to Saddam that Pokemon was actually Hebrew for "I am Jewish," and that because Pokemon was becoming so popular among Iraqi children that this represented a tremendous threat to the very fiber of our nation. You know, you look at this stuff, and again, you know, it's hard to imagine that anyone could take this seriously, but the national level intelligence agencies and presidents of countries were really talking in this way. I find it mind-boggling.
I think that's one of the more interesting things that comes out of the recordings is the degree to which Saddam and his advisors talk about Zionists and all kinds of plots and suspected conspiracies over a very long period of time. When they talk about the Zionists and Israel and so on in the public rhetoric, it's easy to discount as merely intended for external consumption or for regional consumption or consumption within Iraq. However, just the frequency with which it comes up strikes me, it impresses upon me the degree to which Saddam actually bought into a lot of this thinking.
You know, we use a quote we've actually borrowed from a British diplomat referring to Stalin as a lot of what Saddam did and the way he created a system to manipulate his society to remain in power was a, quote, a curious mix of shrewdness and nonsense. And at times the nonsense, you know, from a Western perspective, from our perspective sitting here in Washington, D.C., it's just amazing that they're having this conversation and this is a serious discussion about a strategic issue about the future of a nation, and yet it's just so imbued with all this kind of very strange anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. And then at other times, there's some very thoughtful, you know, look, these things have to happen in order. They're working very hard to manipulate public opinion and to deal with regional leadership issues and some very subtle, complex relationships between peoples within Iraq and within the neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's this odd mix, I think, is what makes Saddam such a fascinating historical character, if nothing else. I mean,
let's close with that thought then. And for both of you, Saddam is gone. He was hanged some years ago. His regime is history. Is there anything really that we can learn that helps us in a practical sort of way, perhaps dealing with other regimes, from listening to the Saddam tapes or from reading these documents? What good, if you will, does this work do us as a country?
Well, I'll say something, and I'll turn it over to David, because I think David is sitting in a place that can really play into this. But you know, I think looking at Saddam, we had a very long relationship with Saddam's Iraq. We, the United States, had a very long relationship, and we are our Western allies. And through that relationship, both in peace and war, during sanctions and tension and lesser tension, we never fully understood the nature of the relationship, the nature of the regime that we were dealing with. And it's clear, so many of the things that we look at now, we look at as our lack of understanding. And this is an opportunity. This is a rare historic opportunity because the government is gone. We did capture senior government records, much like happened after World War II, where we had this tremendous collection of material that let us take apart the Nazi regime and let us put into context the things that we thought we understood with documents that now tell us what might actually have been happening. So beyond being historically fascinating to be able to do that kind of research, it actually should tell us something about what we think, the line of reasoning we apply to a problem, the assumptions we make about the other, the assumptions we make about cause and effect in the international arena. This is I think, an almost unprecedented chance to do a case study that reflects a lot on us. It actually might say less about Iraq. Certainly will say less about Iraq in the future. Then it's almost like looking in a mirror. It's going to tell us a lot about ourselves if we'll take the time to actually study what it presents.
I completely agree with what Kevin said. I'd also add that there are a whole slew of various issues where Iraq provides incredible case studies. Are sanctions efficacious, and what makes them efficacious? How about inspection regimes? How did Saddam's regime game the inspection regimes? And not only what can we learn about Iraq, but what can we learn about the Russians and the Chinese and their involvement and support for these regimes, and lessons that other countries might learn from these experiences.
And you're doing work in how deterrence works or doesn't work, as I understand it.
That's absolutely correct. And I think it's really telling when you look at the tapes from the Cuban Missile Crisis and then look at studies of deterrence, you'll be hard-pressed to find a book on deterrence or coercion or crisis diplomacy that doesn't make reference to those tapes or evidence or findings or theories derived from the tapes. And I think that here we're going to see the same thing. We have several decades worth of tapes from high-level meetings from an authoritarian regime in the Middle East. It's completely unprecedented and will enable us to come out with insights dealing with use and non-use of chemical weapons, as you brought up, perceptions of the U.S., of assurances, and the lack of assurances and so forth. There's just an amazing amount of material.
Well, we could talk for hours about this topic. I know for a fact because we've done it in the past.
Yes.
So we should probably draw a line under it there. But I want to thank both of you, David and Kevin, for a fascinating discussion. And I think there's my name's on the book, but you guys did the real heavy lifting here. And I think this is a fabulous piece of work. And I think there's a lot to be learned about the world, about Saddam, and about Iraq. So thank you so much for joining us here at the International Spy Museum for a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we'll see you next month.